if you decide franchising is for you, you said it, but you didn't say it. So let me double down. You do not want to buy a stupid restaurant franchise. It's the hardest flipping thing out there, bro. You're going to get your ass just handed to you. It may not be today, but like we talked about in the other podcast, it's going to happen a year before you really know what's happening, and you're definitely going out. I hate to be that bad, but I've just seen so many guys jump into it.
What do you really think, Chris?
I mean, I just watched these guys jump into it, and they're like, oh, Chris, I love food. I'm like, dude, so do I. I mean, look at me. Of course I love food.
Welcome to the Small Business Safari, where I help guide you to avoid those traps, pitfalls, and dangers that lurk when navigating the wild world of small business ownership. I'll share those gold nuggets of information and invite guests to help accelerate your ascent up that mountaintop of success. It's a jungle out there, and I want to help you traverse through the levels of owning your own business that can get you bogged down and distract you from achieving your own personal and professional goals. So strap in, adventure team, and let's take a ride through the safari and get you to the mountaintop.
Hey, everybody, it's Chris and Alan again, and we're ready to start rocking the Small Business Safari again. And just like Alan says, I leave all the good stuff before I actually hit record. So we're actually in the middle of the good stuff, and I said, hey, I got to hit record, so let's go do it. So we have John Ossensen on, so we're going to hit cheers.
Now, the whole point of hitting record before we start is that we actually talk before you do what you just did.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
And man, you lost that up.
No magic.
There's no magic there.
Sorry, John.
John, we're so glad to have you on. So now I'm going to give the boring crap because I got to talk about John. What? No, John's the important part. We're the boring crap.
That's exactly right.
Right. I've known John for a number of years, but I just want to give a quick background on him. He supplied his bio, but I'm not going to go with any of that. I'm kidding. He is a franchise consultant, has been involved in a number of different franchises. He actually hails from the Atlanta area, and he is actually a Georgia Bulldog.
Oh, I thought you were going to say an author.
Well, we're going to get to that in just a second so we can shame you a little bit more. And since my son goes to Georgia, now I can say, go Dawgs, all the time. And so if your money goes there, you cheer a lot flipping harder, by the way. So my daughter went to South Carolina, and I could never say the other thing, but so I'd say, go South Carolina, but I couldn't say the other one. That was just not my deal. Even though I'm explicit, it just didn't sound right, but I could say, go Dawgs. So John is a dog. Has his BBA and MBA from the University of Georgia, lives in Atlanta, but chose not to come sit within the studio because what happened, John?
Yeah, I thought I was younger than I was and tore my ACL recently playing basketball, just came off surgery. And one quick correction in the bio, it's national champion Georgia Bulldog.
Oh, national champion. Well, how about that, Alan? And you know what? It's not that you're not young. What we found out is that we're not old, we're seasoned.
Who told us that?
That was, I'm looking right. I remember it was Amanda Griffey from Cowan Supply.
That's right.
Said, Chris, you're not old, you're seasoned. So that's right. But that's national champions, Georgia Bulldogs. How about that?
Yeah. So I paid for two kids to go to Georgia. My third one might end up being a tech. So that could be interesting.
Oh.
But John, you'll enjoy this. I'm an Oregon Duck, and so you know who is coming to town next fall. And I'm like, man, that is just really bad luck on my part for the scheduling. Georgia's coming off a national championship. We're going through our third head coach in 4 years, and Justin Herbert's with the Chargers, and not, you know, in the Ducks' backfield. It's going to be ugly.
I don't want to make a prediction, but I think you have no ducking chance.
Well, we did steal Dan Lanning.
Yeah, well,
there you go.
That's good. John, welcome to the show. We're glad to have you on. There's just so much to talk about. But before we do that, why don't you tell us a little bit about where you came from and how you got here, and then we'll start jumping into everything.
Yeah, well, like you, Chris, and you know, appreciate you guys having me on the show. I love the show, and it's an honor to be here. But Chris, you know, I was at Accenture just like you were, and you know, I think I was more of the peon over there where you were the top dog. But no, did the whole corporate thing.
Is that really
over...
true, John? Because no. I mean, he talks a big game, like he was a big deal.
Alan, you always flatter the host.
Nice. The answer to that, and John is being very gracious, is no. It was the exact flip side. Yeah.
So it had a great run in the corporate world, like so many, but had that itch and chose to scratch it at 36, which was 6 years ago. So dating myself here, and made the jump and stepped into, kind of stumbled into franchising on the franchisor side. So I had the opportunity to come in and serve as president of Shelf Genie Franchise System, which is custom pull-out shelving for kitchens and pantries, and have the opportunity to support all of our franchise owners across North America. And long story short, ended up partnering with the founder. We spun off. We've had a couple of ventures. Some have worked and some haven't. The one that didn't work was outside of franchising, and I learned a lot of lessons through that. All that to say, I'm now currently invested in a number of different franchises personally through different partnerships, and get to spend about 90% of my time, though, on the brokerage side. So get to work with emerging brands and established brands across North America, you know, a couple hundred of them across different industries. And I've kind of coined the term non-food franchising as the space that I work in, because people think franchising, they think fast food. And so by saying non-food franchising, it definitely piques the interest. And 95% of my clients want nothing to do with food. And so we're working in a whole variety of industries, from home services and property services to health and wellness to automotive to, you know, anything related to seniors or kids or pets, you know, all these areas where we're seeing tremendous interest and tremendous growth. And what I found is oftentimes they're not on the radars of people that are looking into business ownership.
I saw that non-food franchising and it just put a huge grin on my face, because as we were speaking off the air, I'm a big fan of franchising, but there's sides of it that I don't like. And so, for example, I moved to Atlanta 20 years ago. I couldn't find a good burger to save my life. And then all of a sudden, one brand opens up. And then the next thing you know, there's 10 other franchise brands that all kind of have their little cult-like thing saying, oh, but we do it different. And the bottom line is it was a customized burger just under a different brand, and it drove me crazy. And it's like, in franchising, you run the risk of killing the goose that laid the golden egg. And then all of a sudden it was the pizza franchises, and then it was the cupcake franchises, and it drives me crazy, because every time I see a store go dark, I know that was somebody's life's dreams that were going away. And not to say that food franchises are bad, because there's some that you can, I mean, there's a lot of great ones out there. But it just seems like more of a throwing spaghetti against the wall and seeing what sticks. Whereas, so you've eliminated that. So it's kind of like hitting a fade all the time playing golf. You eliminate, you know, the left side of the fairway.
Nice. Yeah. Nice golf analogy. Yeah. I'm going to rip that in there, because I know John's interested in golf.
But there's a lot of crazy non-food franchises too. The axe throwing is the one that's caught my attention. I'm like, how did that ever pass insurance policy?
you sound very corporate now. Oh, you're killing me. Alan's getting all corporate on us. All right, before we get off this, this is where we have to go quite a bit, because John has a lot of experience in the franchising. And we're talking to people who think about being in corporate America. You just heard from John, had that big job, got into franchising. Now he's looking at, and we decide franchising, not franchising. But if you decide franchising is for you, You said it, but you didn't say it. So let me double down. You do not want to buy a stupid restaurant franchise. It's the hardest flipping thing out there, bro. You're going to get your ass just handed to you. It may not be today, but like we talked about in the other podcast, it's going to happen a year before you really know what's happening, and you're definitely going out. I hate to be that bad, but I've just seen so many guys jump into it.
What do you really think, Chris?
I mean, I just watched these guys jump into it, and they're like, oh, Chris, I love food. I'm like, dude, so do I. I mean, look at me. Of course I love food. But come on, it's just hard. The only one I've heard that I thought was viable, and the guy still didn't jump into it, was Subway. Because Subway, the way you could actually achieve the goals that you want to, and again, financially, is you had to have at least 3 stores.
Yeah, you got to have 10 of them.
Yeah. Well, what are you doing now? That's no fun.
Right.
I mean, there's zero fun in that, right? I mean,
should have our guest actually come in.
I'm sorry. Yeah, let's ask the expert. John, what do you think? Where should we go?
Yeah. You know, I mean, again, I think there's, you know, people questioning, should I take the franchise path, or should I, you know, start something on my own? And, you know, I have to tell a lot of my clients that franchising is not right for everyone. But for a lot of people, it does make a better path to business ownership. And, you know, you get the advantages from the franchising of having a playbook. You've got the coach on the sidelines in that franchisor. You've got other franchisees in other markets you can learn from. You know, and so you're in business for yourself, but not by yourself. You're starting on third base, not first base, to go ultra cliche on you guys. But, you know, really, something that oftentimes goes overlooked is the fact that you can make some really great returns. And, you know, even upon an exit, so there's really three things that I point to on the financial side. You can build up a cash flow along the way. You can write off expenses that as a business owner, you couldn't otherwise, or as, you know, a corporate W-2, you couldn't otherwise. And then finally, that exit. And I think a lot of people forget about that exit potential, but there was actually a study done recently. They looked at 2,000 businesses, the Titus School of Franchising down there in Tampa, and they analyzed over a 10-year period exits across a wide variety of industries, franchise versus non-franchise. And they found that franchise businesses traded at a multiple 1.5 times non-franchise. And so you see that on the local level, but also on the corporate franchisor level. I've had several calls today with private equity firms that are wanting to get a pulse on what's going on because they love franchising because you can scale using other people's money. There's just a lot of benefits to the whole franchise model on the franchisor side. And we're seeing acquisition after acquisition right now at that corporate level as well. So I'd say lots of interest out there. You know, a lot of people, again, don't understand everything that's offered from an industry standpoint, which we can jump into next. But yeah, a lot of great activity going on all over the place.
All right, Alan. I'm going to let you go next.
Oh, I was talking about that.
I know.
No, but you bring up a really good point when it comes to resale. If Chris opens a burger stand and wants to sell it, it's Chris's Burgers. But if he opens something that has a brand name that people understand, and you know, there's a lot more power to that. And I would assume it's a lot easier to remarket.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, oftentimes that franchisor has a pipeline of people that were interested in that same business for that same market, but was sold out. So now all of a sudden you've got a list of people to reach out to. And no, it's, and oftentimes, I mean, we personally, one of our businesses is a Driveway franchise. And we don't even have to market it. There's such demand, our phone rings off the hook. And I've placed 5 clients in this business. Each of them has come back and bought additional locations.
Is it fixing cracks or?
Crack and joint repair. It's mud jacking or leveling of concrete. And then it's new pours as well. And I mean, there's no other national player in there. So when you can bring the professional white collar approach to a blue collar industry, you know, it sets you up for success in a lot of cases. But where I was going with the Driveway company is we, with my partners, have acquired 2 other franchisees that were, you know, congruent to us. And so we've been able to scale that way through acquisition. It gives them a natural exit as well. So you do get some synergies around that. But no, it's an interesting time out there. And, you know, we talked about food. We talked about axe throwing. I mean, to me, that's just too trendy. And there are easier, safer ways to make money. And Chris, I know this is right up your alley, but I mean, what's attractive right now? I mean, we're doing deals in automotive and health and wellness, but there's nothing bigger than home services and property services, that whole $600 billion market. And everything from, you know, it's that non-sexy roll-off dumpsters to ServPro, you know, these essential services that are very Amazon-resistant, you know, to a degree, recession-resistant, COVID-resistant. Some are B2C, some are B2B, some are a hybrid, but insulation, gutters, I mean, stuff like that, people are gravitating towards, even if they have no background in that space.
That's a great point that you just talked about, because where are we right now? We are post-COVID. We are looking at high inflation happening. We're seeing gas prices. We're seeing, unfortunately, a Russian-Ukrainian conflict. Total bullshit, but I'm not going to get political on you. Somewhere along the line, we're going to have a correction. Somewhere along the line, our economy has to. And that's what Gino Wickman talks about this. If you're in business for 10 years, 2 of them are going to be bad. You just don't know which 2. I happen to pick the first 2 right out of the gates, 2008. So there you go. And then we have a recession that's happened back. But honestly, I had a 2-month problem. I didn't have a 2-year problem. So as you look at what you're going to get into, the economy has to, it will. I mean, history serves somewhere along the line, these next couple of years, something's going to happen. And John just hit on it. It's relatively recession resistant. Your house, if you own it, is going to need maintenance. Your house, if you own it, is going to need repairs. Why not pick an industry which is relatively recession resistant? And then a new phrase, and I want to put that out there, it's also Amazon resistant.
Right.
Wow. How about that? I used to say it couldn't be outsourced. But the minute I can find a robot to do work in people's houses, dude, I'm totally on that because this employee thing, no, I'm just kidding. But you can't outsource it. You offshore. So why not get into home services? Because you know it's coming. And if you weather that storm and you just hit on the three things that John talked about, was you get cash flow, you can write off expenses, but you also have an exit strategy. And you have an exit commodity where Chris's trusted toolbox, you know, I'm growing to a point now, but Chris's handyman business would have had no value. It would have been give it to my kids or just give it to somebody else or just shut the doors. And I've seen so many people do that in the home services business.
John, a quick question for you. Every once in a while I hear about part-time franchises, and I've always kind of had the mindset, you can't have one foot here and the other foot there. You need to have both feet wherever you are. What are your thoughts about part-time franchises? Is that a real thing?
It's a real thing, but you have to go in eyes wide open and understand that it requires having a good general manager. So literally half of my clients today are jumping in full-time owner-operator. You know, I just had a Wall Street attorney outside of Boston buy into a gutter business. He's going to run that business. Is he going up on a ladder? No. Does he want to run it forever? No. But what he'll do is scale it up a little, get his hands dirty, put a general manager in place. The other half of my clients say, hey, day one, I want to have a general manager in place. I want to do the bookkeeping. I want to do the referral partnerships and hang out in the Chamber of Commerce, you know, do my high payoff activities in their eyes. And in those cases, it is doable, but you have to have a good general manager. You know, I've got a client in Columbia, South Carolina, who's become a good friend of mine, 40 years old, largest franchisee of Two Men in a Truck, a moving service, operates in 10 markets, $30 million business. He and I did a couple of deals together last year outside of Two Men, where in each case, he put a young GM, late 20s, over the business, gave them some equity. And these were guys that he'd gotten to know, oftentimes through church or another means. And he said, hey, go make us proud. In each case, he's come back and bought additional locations within the first year from everyone that he's purchased through me. And so it can be done. I'm actually now using him to coach some of my clients on how do you align incentives with the GM? How do you find them? How do you set them up for success? So it can be done. I just think you have to understand what it takes going in. And there are businesses that require you to be owner-operator, but the vast majority of the ones we work with allow for that semi-absentee. And most of them require or prefer you have no background in that industry. And so over 80% of my clients come and say, hey, I'm going to be open-minded, but I kind of like this area. Well, once we peel back the onion and understand what they want that day-to-day role to look like, the financial returns, everything else, over 80%, maybe even 90% end up in an area they never thought about, never on their radar. So that makes my job a lot of fun to kind of help turn the light bulbs on and help them understand what's out there.
Let's go through that process a little bit because I'm really interested. I think a lot of people listen to this. I don't know if this is for me. Should I actually talk to John? Why should I talk to John? I have my inner circle. I have my group of people and I know what I'm talking about. But as we all know, we're very myopic. We only know what our little world is about. And why talking to John? Who comes and talks to you, John? Let's open it up because I've got a feeling that a lot of people you talk to are everybody who's listening here. They just didn't know they should be talking to you. So who's calling you?
Yeah, well, we work across North America. You know, I've got clients in almost every state and we've done deals this year to date, and they're guys and gals in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, male and female, all sorts of backgrounds. You know, I'd say from a net worth standpoint, you know, a wide variety of net worth, you know, there are a few clients I'll have to say, hey, until you get to that 150,000 range, and that can include home equity too, you probably shouldn't be buying a business just yet. And so that's kind of a bar that I use, but you know, most are, you know, not too much ahead of that. But no, I'd say it's entirely free to work with me. It's a great model. It's a clean model. I get paid by the franchisors on the back end. None of that gets passed on to my clients in any way. So it's a great model, very non-salesy. I can be very consultative. And I love just getting on a call and sharing what I'm seeing out there, getting to know my client, and then bringing them opportunities, oftentimes 7 or 8 opportunities that are available in their market that fit what they've shared with me. These are franchisors where I know them. I know their backgrounds, strong leadership teams, good financial models, uniques in their niches. And they're also opportunities that I've seen resonate with other people across the country with a background similar to my clients. And so it helps narrow down this world. I mean, there's about 4,000 franchise brands in the US alone. Probably half of those are in food. And so we start narrowing it down. And then I'd say at any given time, I've got my 30 to 40 that I really, really like. I've done my due diligence, and those are the ones that I'll take my clients through.
What advice would you give to somebody other than just going with you, but when they're choosing a franchise broker? There's a lot of brands out there, and if you go to any chamber meeting throughout the city, you're going to meet somebody who's a franchise broker, and I think you earlier used the phrase eyes wide open. I think who you choose to represent you in selecting a business has a lot to do with your future success and failure. So what are some things that you think differentiate your company, but just things that people should look for in general?
Yeah. I'd say from my perspective, you know, someone that has been a franchisee themselves, you know, I think that would be,
that's a great one.
That'd be number one.
Oh, nugget.
That's right.
Layer in if they have franchisor experience, you know, which again, I've been fortunate to have both of those, but you know, just because you bring different perspectives to the table. At Shelf Genie, I saw a sea of franchise owners. I saw who was successful, who was less successful, and why that was, working day in, day out with them. So it helps me from a perspective, you know, someone that does a lot of deals, that is very active out there, that the franchisors will do favors for, that we've been able to get our clients larger territories or little you know, one-offs, not always, but sometimes you're able to leverage those relationships. And so, you know, what I tell someone, if you go online, you're going to look at a lot of websites. However, you know, someone may show five locations, but what you don't know that's not shown on the websites, there's 50 more locations that have been, deals have been done recently, but they're not showing up. The leadership team, let's go really deep and understand, do they have industry experience or franchise experience? If they have industry experience, that's great, but let's make sure they brought on a team of franchise experienced individuals around them. Because that franchise or franchisee relationship, it's a partnership. It's a dynamic that you don't want to shortchange. You know, and then just what do you look for in the validation calls? I mean, the goal is for you to be able to go into making that decision on buying a business with eyes wide open. You get the FDD, which is a big intimidating document, but it gives you everything you could ever want to know. You get to talk to other franchise owners in the system. They can be an open book, share their numbers, their ramp up. You know, here's what I like, here's what I don't like. And then, you know, I'm serving as a sounding board with them through that process. And so, you know, I'd say right now it's extremely competitive out there. You know, good brands are going fast in good markets. I mean, Atlanta is always one of the first ones to go. Atlanta, Dallas, Charlotte, Raleigh. I mean, Florida is just, things are hot. And so oftentimes we're positioning our clients against other candidates for the same brands in the same market. And again, it comes down to kind of working those relationships. So just a couple of thoughts off the top of my head.
What makes somebody not good for franchisee ownership? So
they're
going to come talk to you. Yeah. Go ahead.
Too entrepreneurial. I mean, if you can't live within the lines, I'm a member of the Entrepreneurs Organization. And what I found is, you know, a lot of them say, hey, I love the idea of franchising. Mm-hmm. For some of them, it's great. For some of them, it's like, no, you wouldn't be able to stay within the guardrails here. Now, it's interesting. Some of them say, hey, I've been there, done that. I'd rather not recreate the wheel. I love the idea of having, you know, product market fit already determined. And you know, day one, we're working on that path to profitability. We're not trying to have to figure out, can this be profitable? So it comes down to the individual. But I'd say the biggest thing is someone that says, hey, I don't need all this. I can do it myself. And I don't see the value.
So are you finding, you know, in today's world, the labor shortage is just brutal, and labor costs are escalating in a ridiculous manner. Are there franchises people can get that aren't necessarily as labor intensive, or at least are designed, the model is designed where the employees can share in the success? Are you steering people in that direction now?
Yeah, no, you hit the nail on the head, Alan. I mean, across the country, the number one thing on people's minds is labor, and you know, is labor going to be an issue? And you know, they're really across most industries, we see great demand. I mean, it's just like the headlines that we read, but the labor is the challenge. I mean, I've lived through it. We figure out some ways to help mitigate the labor challenges, but no, everyone is saying, "Hey, give me the highest return opportunities with the fewest number of employees." Now, I'd say to a degree that's always been the case, but even more so now. So no, we have plenty of opportunities. I just had a client buy a business coaching franchise up in Indianapolis. I had a client buy a trash smashing business. And you guys may have seen this. This is cool. It's roll off dumpsters. You go up, you got a truck with a big old crane arm and rolls back and forth inside the dumpster. So we've done smash my trash deals, crusher deals.
All right. So here at my office, we actually use smash my trash. I got to jump in because I love talking about it. I actually love it so much. Like, I know when he comes, I'm like the kid. It's like, I'm the kid. I'm like, here comes the ice cream man, the ice cream man, the ice cream man, here he comes. And I can hear him out there. I go running out back and I watch him smash my trash. What a great business model. Now, I watched that stuff and I've heard it's great. I've heard it from a number of different podcasts and avenues. But for me as a business owner, cost me about $500 a month, but saves me on dumpster pulls probably around $1,000. So I'm good. You know, it's a good savings for me, right? But I love it when they do that. It's just so cool. So smash my trash. And what's the other one?
Yeah, there's another one, Crusher, that and it's got some uniques to it. And Scott Dennison, the founder, I'm a big fan of, and yeah, I'm happy to chat about that one. But no, that business came to mind because here you've got, you know, it's capital intensive. I mean, it's a higher buy-in cost. You got a heavy equipment. I mean, it's Section 179 eligible, all that jazz. But it's very few employees. I mean, you know, you got one guy driving a truck, doesn't require a CDL license. So it's a large labor pool. I mean, maybe you have another salesperson outside of that running demo appointments. But by and large, it's not. You don't scale through more headcount in a big way. You know, a lot of home services businesses, it is adding headcount. You know, I go back to that example of the driveway business we have. I mean, right now we've got two salaried employees, a general manager and an assistant general manager. And we're going to do probably $2 million next year in that business in revenue using 1099 labor. Now, that sounds great on paper. We all know that you've got to find good subs, but you build up that bench over time through trial and error. But if you can provide a steady workflow to people to do quality work and show up on time over time, you build up that base.
All right. I want to use your brain to figure out the future. Not for everybody listening, but for me. No, because
it is all about you.
Thank you, Chris. What do you see if you said right now, this is where we're going? What are some of the best franchise concepts with good runways going? I know we talked home services, but in general, where would you say, man, if it was me putting my money, I'm going to go this way?
Well, Chris, I'd say just looking at you, I think about our aging population and those, you know, 65 and above. So a couple of ideas there. That doesn't have to be it. Go ahead.
It's fair. It's fair because not only am I bald, and I was in a meeting the other day with a bunch of other CEOs, and the guy looked at me and said, well, I think, Chris, you're the oldest one here. We went around the room. I was the second youngest.
Oh, my.
I said, I realize I look 104, boys, but that's because I've been beating my head against the wall for 14 years and drinking way too much. Cheers. All right, John. I love it. Aging population.
The mileage.
I love it. And by the way, I'm not old. I'm seasoned. That's right. Amanda said I'm seasoned.
John, I'm starting to see mental health franchises pop up. Is that an emerging brand?
Yeah. No, we've got several to play in that space.
Yeah, and suddenly we have a bunch of people looking for mental health places.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, no, there's one, Ellie Mental Health, that's really been growing fast. There are a few others out there. But no, I think about with the aging population, I mean, your mind probably goes to in-home senior care and visiting angels and all that. But there's so many other businesses that cater to that aging population. I think of one that's it's a fitness concept in a smaller footprint, maybe 1,200 square feet. Many that are 50 and above don't like the big box gym environment. And yet there's only one national brand out there that really caters to that group. And great technology, all of that. Just had a client out of the University of Arkansas. She's a PhD out there, was looking for a side hustle, and she bought into this business. You know, another one, custom orthotics, you know, insoles and shoes. And, you know, it could be for any ages, but they do a lot of business with Medicare, and they use 3D printing to do the milling and fabricating of the custom insoles. You know, another one, I mean, people are aging in place. They don't want to go to nursing homes. I mean, that's true before the pandemic, all the more true now. And so that could be, you know, things like I mentioned Shelf Genie. I mean, that could be, you know, just helping, you know, not only provide storage, but also, you know, ease and mobility around the house. Or it could be a business that provides, you know, bathroom retrofitting and wheelchair ramps and stair lifts and chair lifts. And, you know, so there are a lot of ways to serve the community and really do good. you know, through something along those lines and make pretty good money.
So he definitely helped me.
In what way?
Well, number one, I'm getting old and I don't have a great head of hair like he does either. Damn it.
Yeah, you need to pick your guests better. So far, we've been on a streak of people with great heads of hair.
I know. You
good,
know what?
Good bit of gray here, though.
Oh, stop it. Bitch. That's it. You know what? I told Alan, from now on, I'm only picking people that are less than me because I want to feel more superior. And I feel always less than now.
Starting after John.
After John. That's it. Because obviously these guys come out and John's kicking it out of the park. But the aging in place part is huge, especially in the Atlanta area. What I found early on was I watched a couple guys jump in on the aging in place, but Atlanta 10 years ago wasn't quote unquote old yet. And now I'm definitely seeing, we're getting asked to do a number of those things. And you hit on something. I'll give you my own experience. What happens? The pandemic hits and you're like, oh gosh, what's going to happen to my business? It's going to crater. It did not. I was lucky enough. I was able to scale it. I did. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm going to start crying if I think about it too much. I laid off a lot of people, but I started running a little really lean and mean. But in the span of 2 months with my handyman, people who wanted you to work at their house was outside. We built 4 ramps. And because 4 different families said, I've got to get my mom, my dad out of the daycare, or I mean, the daycare, the, what do they call that? Assisted living.
Assisted living.
Actually, that was a Freudian slip, daycare, assisted living, because I'm going through the same thing with my own family, but I had to get them out, or dad was coming out of the hospital, and there was no way in hell they were going to put him in an old person's unit because of the COVID crisis. 4 ramps in the span of a month where I probably have built since then, probably 4 more. Not that many, but the aging in place piece is so big that's happening because people are like, do I really want to go to one of these places where if this happens again, which God forbid it does, I don't know if I want to be around all these people. I think I want to stay at my own house. So I think at least our market's there. I'm sure the rest of the nation, especially up in the Northeast, has had it too. So that's a great point. Aging in place would be a great place to put your money or take a bet.
And Chris, really, I mean, when I think about it, people love their kids, their pets, their health, their homes. I mean, they're going to continue to spend on businesses that support those. I mean, pets have only taken off even more since, you know, whether it be vet services or doggy daycares or dog walking franchises, you have everything out there these days. With kids, I mean, things like martial arts and just alternative sports and such, home services, huge, but health and wellness. I mean, that's a big one too. I mean, there are a few that do regenerative type health. And we just did a deal recently, 10 locations up in New Jersey. It's an IV drip business. Now, it's not just the hydration, like a lot of people think, but it was started by 2 doctors that with these drips, they can actually reduce heavy metals in the blood in the body, fight free radicals, reduce toxins at the cellular level, and really boost immunity, which I mean that covers your, you know, not only the aging population all the way down to the high school athlete and the soccer mom, but I think a business like that's going to require a degree of educating the market. However, that's absolutely the direction that things are moving.
Wow. That's actually a nice adjunct to the aging in place. You're right. The IV, the wellness part. Getting into that stuff.
You need IV, Chris.
Of course, every day I need IV. Well, John called me out, but he's not the first one to clearly call me out as being old and clearly malnutrition. Not, it's wrong nutrition because I love my beer and food. It's just I'm not getting the right vitamins in me. So I need to IV it up.
So, John, I got a question for you. You were talking earlier about, Chris asked, you know, what makes a good candidate? And one of the things is not being too entrepreneurial. So for somebody listening to this who's thinking about getting out of the corporate world and they want to start their own business, you know, what are some things you can tell them as to help them make that decision? Should I just go a hardcore entrepreneur or is the franchise route for me? What are things they should consider?
Yeah, when I said too entrepreneurial, I mean, you have to have a degree of entrepreneurism, you know, to start a franchise. I mean, nothing's easy. And we do some resale deals where it's an existing business. However, I'd say 90% of ours are, you know, new to the market. I think just sharing different case studies of clients of mine that have made that jump and, you know, kind of what's gone through their head. And you know, a lot of them climb that diving board and some walk out to the end and some make the jump, some many don't. There's this fascinating psychology that I get to tap into. But You know, to me, if you're working for the man, if you're building someone else's empire and not your own, you know, oftentimes people see that as safer, but is it really safe working for someone else? I mean, I think it's safer working for myself. I trust myself more than I do, you know, being at the whim of some senior management team in a corporation. And I've been there, I've done that. You know, I've had the corporate experience. And could have done that forever. But I think to really come alive, I mean, I've never looked back, never once looked back. I'm grateful for my experience back then. But for me, I was cut out to do something a little more creative and on my own. And I still pinch myself. I mean, again, this is my experience, but I can share case studies of clients of mine that have made the choice. And I love watching them succeed. I have had one client where it didn't work out, you know, full transparency. The rest of them, you know, so far, you know, it's worked out very well. And there were some nuances around that one. He lived out of market and he could have kept going, but he chose not to. But no, you just have, I mean, you look at the numbers, you have a higher success rate stepping in, you have a lot less legwork, you know, starting up, ramping up.
But there is a dividing line. And I'm a firm believer in, you know, if you've got a strong entrepreneurial spirit, but maybe your risk tolerance isn't as great, for example, franchising is a perfect opportunity for you because all those really expensive mistakes that you're going to make starting your own business, somebody else has already made them. That's been vetted out. You're not going to make them as a franchisee. And I did have a stint for a number of years working at a franchisor's office. And, you know, the phrase that we award franchises was a big deal. And there were people that you would turn down. And there were some people that, man, they've got the drive, they've got the motor, they've got the money. And you had to have a lot of discipline to say, I don't know if you're going to be a good franchisee, because you do have to play within a defined box. And they're, you know, they would say, oh, yeah, yeah, I'll follow the brand standards, I'll follow the model. And if, whatever their background was, if they came from a marketing background, the second they bought the franchise, next thing you know, they're trying to do their own marketing outside of the franchise guide and recommendations. And it just was so frustrating for them and for the franchisor, and they weren't as successful as if they followed a successful model. So that's kind of the gist of my original question is, how can somebody weed themselves out of that so that people that do go to you for a franchise are people who are more wired for that?
Yeah, I'd say when I looked across our sea of franchisees at Shelf Genie, the ones that were the most successful were the ones that followed the process. And that sounds cliche, but I promise it was true. Our franchise owners that were doing a couple million a year across the board were following the system. And the other ones were too smart for their own good. And but I mean, the vast majority, even those that were the low performers, I mean, they were still doing okay. It's just all relative. And what I found is, I mean, at Shelf Genie, and this is true of a lot of franchise systems, we'd have someone go through the whole process. They'd meet the team. They'd say, wait a minute, you're doing the marketing, making the phones ring. You're answering the phones. You're booking appointments. You're doing, what do we do day in, day out? And my answer inevitably was get involved at the grassroots level, hire good people, retain them, incentivize them, make tough calls when needed. And the people that did that the best, I mean, you've got to like working with people to some degree in most of these businesses. And that's really the biggest determinant of success is what I found.
So they say the axiom when you're in the law is always know the answer before you ask the question. So this one, I don't know the answer, but I'm going to ask him anyway. John, you took the leap from Accenture. You went out to do the franchising. Did you ever have the oh shit moment? Oh my God, what have I just done to my family? I got to stop. I got to go back. Did you ever have that, or has everything just been sunshine and roses for you since you started?
Never. No, not all sunshine and roses. Never once did I think, oh, I should go back. You know, I was very fortunate. I mean, I got in with Carter's, Oshkosh B'gosh. We had a great run, stock options very early in my career. And so all that built up to give me the freedom, I'd say even more so, to be able to step out and not feel like I was taking a risk. You know, I took a salary cut when I went to Shelf Genie, big time salary cut. Even though I had an elevated title, I took a salary cut. But I was willing to do that because I saw where it was taking me. But one thing I didn't hit on, so when I found Alan Young, the founder of Shelf Genie, and I spun off, we worked out an arrangement with Shelf Genie. We outsourced, we pulled out the call center and the marketing teams and the technology team. We were still supporting Shelf Genie, but now we started supporting other franchise systems as well. it looked great on paper. I built up our team. We had 40 employees. This was a non-franchise business, but we were supporting franchises. And again, we were making the phones ring. We're answering the phones. Great model. We became too custom, and I thought the market was willing to pay for it, and they weren't. And so I saw the writing on the wall and had to make a very tough call to wind down that business. We found homes for our people, for the most part, homes for our clients. Very proud of how we handled it. But yeah, that was a trying time. I mean, that was not sunshine and roses. That was looking my leadership team in the face and saying, hey, here's, you know, what we've been excited about and the vision that we had, but it's not materializing. I don't see it materializing from a profitability standpoint for the effort that we're putting in. The model's not there. And so, you know, to me, that was a tough call. Never looked back on that, not a once. And absolutely love what I'm doing now, but it's also given me that perspective of, you know, having a business outside of franchising where you don't have that peer group and that guidance and that framework. I was doing a lot of guessing, pretty high stakes guessing.
You're doing some high stakes guessing as a guy who's done it. Yeah, I'm with you. So you just hit on this. We make a lot of mistakes, and then I've learned from somebody, you can't say mistakes, they're opportunities, Chris. I'm like, yeah, but why does every opportunity cost me so much flippant money? Man, it just kills me. So you watch one not work. When you sit there and go, well, yeah. So we can use the F word, and I'm going to use it because Alan's next to me. We failed. But Alan is the most successful failed entrepreneur I've ever met in my life. And people still ask him to go back and talk to him and speak at conferences and speak all this stuff. In fact, they ask him to speak way more than me. I'm not jealous. Okay, yes, I am. Don't tell Alan. But that's just the thing. We don't fail. We have to learn. You've got to, as an entrepreneur, got to build on your optimism and know that this is the track. Because did I ever look back and say, I'm going to go back? No. Did I look and have that oh shit moment at 3:30 in the morning going, what have I just done to my family? Yes, I have twice in my 14-year run. And then people look at me now and go, man, Chris, you're so successful. You're doing so great. And I go, yeah, I'm a 14-year in the making overnight success. I said, but those first 4 years, brother, I'm going to tell you, there's a reason I have no hair and I look 104, as you guys have both mentioned. So
no, it's failing fast, right?
Fail fast. That's a great concept. We talked about this in another podcast. Is that
it's a good book title, Chris? Maybe that would be a bestseller.
Failing fast. Yeah. That would mean I'd have to fail. Uh oh.
Yeah, they talk about failing forward, but I think failing fast. Hey, cut your losses, make a call. Let's move on.
Yeah. So, John, you mentioned that we've talked about this in another podcast. I think a lot of times we're so overly optimistic as entrepreneurs and small business owners that we give it that one more year, and we should have closed it or we should have sold it earlier than we do. Have you gone across anybody who's actually selling a franchise that they were looking at it and you went, man, dude, let me tell you, I've been there and at least I unwound mine faster. Let me tell you, you got to have that hard talk and look your leadership team in the face and say, I'm done. Or look yourself in the face in the mirror and go, I'm done.
Yeah, I think both ways. You know, I had a client in Dallas 2 weeks ago that I talked with, and he had bought a second location of a franchise, got off to a good start, and he wasn't willing to leave his job. And what he needed to do was leave his job. He needed to give the business the attention because it had the potential, but he was nervous about making that jump. And so he was thinking he was going to sell it. That's why he called me. We had a call. I set him up with another guy. He got off the call. He's like, I'm going to double down on this business. Let's go. And so I think, you know, sometimes it goes that direction. Other times it is, hey, the one franchisee that I had where it didn't work out outside of Nashville, about 3 hours outside of Nashville, bought into a mosquito business. He was a CPA. But I think for a business like that, and we had a cold spring and all these macro factors, but I think for him living outside the market for a business like that, that is so, you know, let's get some friends and family, putting out yard signs. You know, I think that was a lesson to me as well that, hey, some businesses you can operate remote. But I think for one like that, just getting it off the ground. Now, if he hung with it, he would have been fine. But he got about 3 or 4 months in and said, this is going to be too much effort living outside the market. I'm going to make a tough call. And I said, go for it.
So hard to make that tough call, especially going back to the optimism and surrounding yourself with good people and also people who can then tell you, not they're negative, but they can also tell you, look, man, brother, I've been there. You either do this and go up, where you do this and say, I'm cutting my losses, I'm going to go do something else. And now after 14 years, you know, I got into this and somebody said, Chris, will you ever go back? I said, they would never have me back because I clearly I'm the alien in the room. I am too entrepreneurial. I would never have gone the franchise route and been successful because I would have been the guy going, no, system, screw you, John. I'm not doing no system. I got my own system, baby.
And it's great when you find a franchisor that, you know, those are the things you want to find out during the process. You know, how big are those boundaries going to be? I mean, great example. Last week, I reached out to, or maybe 2 weeks ago, I reached out to Courtney, president of the Driveway Company out in Waco, Texas. We have a great relationship. I said, hey, we just had an opportunity fall in our lap to sponsor a NASCAR for the big Atlanta road race this weekend. And I said, you know, it's $15,000. I'm going to chip in $5,000 for my consulting business. We want to make the Driveway Company the official big lead sponsor on the car. We'll pitch in $5,000. Will you pitch in $5,000 from corporate? She said, absolutely, let's do it. She has blasted that thing all over social media, shown it to all the franchisees. And it's one of those things, like, we don't have to go through all the bureaucratic approvals. It was like, hey, let's do it. And so I love working with franchisors. And that's one of those things that I try to be very selective. Are they going to really be a partner? Are they going to get excited about things in your local market that you're excited about? And not be in an ivory tower. And there are a lot of really, not all franchise systems are created equal, but there's some really good ones out there with really good people behind them. And those are the ones we enjoy working with.
God, he just hit on something. I can't do it. I can't stop myself. NASCAR, baby. He sponsored NASCAR here in Atlanta, Folds of Honor. One of my closet passions is NASCAR. I had a buddy owned a race team and actually went to the Daytona 500 this year. Been there a number of times. Loved it. So which driver did you sponsor?
Yeah, Sage Karam, who, if you remember, he's the one that up at Pocono, you know, had the accident that then ended up killing someone else a couple of years ago in the IndyCar. And so, yeah, very difficult recovery for him, but pretty powerful testimony and story behind him. And just a great rock solid team. So we really enjoyed getting behind them and supporting them.
All right. Well, if you want to do it again, I got some inroads. I'll get you back in. And I love that because it's not about driving up front in NASCAR. And we've talked about this before. This is a great marketing idea. Now, a great marketing thesis really is that the NASCAR fan is not the trailer park trash that everybody thinks they are. They're actually 90,000 in household income or more. They have discretionary income over 20,000. They have two income jobs. They have homes. They usually have a secondary home. So the market in NASCAR is actually more affluent than people think or more in line. So that's what I'm telling you, baby. We're not all rednecks.
Okay. I'll sponsor a car. Is that what you're going for?
That's what I want. No, but
you still find more folks with six fingers than you do elsewhere. So
that's true. I love my boys in Daytona. If you've ever followed me on TikTok or Instagram, go out there. You got to follow.
Chris, you're on TikTok,
dude, baby. I am Chris Talk, baby. Customer service talk.
Oh boy, John, you opened a Pandora's box that we will not.
Okay, all right,
John, you got to go follow me. I am funny. Come on, Alan. I make Alan do TikToks and we do podcasts. You know what? We're TikToking, baby. No. We're going to have John TikTok with us? No.
All John's right. Not a TikToker. I can see it.
All right, John. I think we're coming to the end of our time and I've really enjoyed our time, but we've got to ask our three questions. So my first question is, what is the favorite feature of your house?
So we bought a house in Buckhead and restored it, old 1930s home. Bought it 2 years ago. It's been a process. A lot of stories around it. But the number one thing that we're so glad we did out there around the pool and really we expanded the whole backyard was we put in artificial turf. And it's good quality artificial turf. And it was a game changer. The kids love it. They do snow angels in it. Highly recommend it.
Artificial turf. I love that. You do too.
You just hit it with a blower. You don't have to mess with, I mean,
artificial turf.
Yeah. If you've got a shady backyard, then you're constantly reseeding in it. You just have a crappy lawn all the time. It's never muddy.
You know, I've often said on this podcast, this is no judgment zone, but I'm judging both of you. Are you kidding me? No, I'm kidding. I love it. All right. Artificial turf. All right. Artificial turf. How about that? Huh. I would have gone for heated floors in my bathroom. Still my favorite.
Nobody was asking you.
Oh, shit. I'm sorry. All right. Back to John. I forgot. Podcast about John. All right. Number two, we all love customer service. In fact, that's our tagline. That's my TikTok. That's my Instagram, customerservice.freak. Go check me out. What is your biggest customer service pet peeve?
Which one? It would have to be those overly salesy sales guys that just got out of training and they're giving you all the sales speak of the process. We had one come in for some waterproofing in an area of our basement a few weeks ago. And man, it was just painful to listen to him about how he talked about it. It was
too processed to customer service. Yeah.
We were just talking about this the other day here at the company. Today's salesman has got to know, number one, the customer is informed. And number two, you are not there to sell on the one call close. You need to make sure, number one, how far are they educated? And number two, what's a solution that works best for them? And then either give options or give time. Because the copier salesman door to door, the encyclopedia salesman door to door, really dating myself, but remember, I'm 104.
Sucking us down with you.
I am. Those guys were sellers, right? Because you had no education, no information, and you just hit it. When you go out there and this guy just hits you and he's just going over the top, you're like, dude, I've already figured out what's going on. Educate me. Show me you know what you're doing. If I trust you and believe you, then I'll buy. But don't keep hitting me with all the sales bullshit. That's huge. I did say bullshit. All right, keep going. Number three. And you actually hit on it earlier. Give us a DIY nightmare story in your house.
DIY, gosh.
Or do you outsource most of it?
Yeah, we outsource most of it.
Give us a contractor nightmare story.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, pick one.
So, okay, my wife
remodeling an entire house from 19.
Yeah, yeah. We remodeled.
Could you pick from?
I was going to say we remodeled a few homes. I think it's the blocking and tackling, the low hanging fruit. If you're a contractor and. You know, my wife's was an interior designer back before I had kids. She's at home now, but I mean, she used to work with builders. She knows what she wants. She has detailed specs. And in our last home, she wanted Benjamin Moore shaker beige cut with white. It was very specific what she wanted. She walks in one day, the builder had painted it and had his paint crews. And she's like, oh no, they used the Home Depot knockoff. I mean, she knew it immediately. They had to repaint the whole thing. Our current home, you'll like this one. So our contractor, we wanted solid wood core doors, you know, higher quality. It's what they would have had in a 1930s home. Our builder had all the doors installed and painted, and they were not solid wood core, but he tried to convince us that they were. And so anyway, there were some variation and, you know, I mean, they were heavier than some, but not as heavy. So he's now having to replace every door in our house and repaint them and rehang them. And it was all on him.
Oh, wow. I love the fact that he said, I tried to convince him they did. It's like, look, hey, look, they're not, it's not an echo.
I can see John's wife, like, just kicking one of the panels out of the door.
And then he tried to convince us that those doors were superior to the other. He said, you can come over to my house and see our wooden doors, and you'll see they're just about the same. We said, wait a minute, you put wooden doors in your house, but not in ours. It's just...
Wow. How about that one? No, they're not hollow. They're not echo. They're solid. Yeah, give me a freaking hammer. Watch this, big boy. Whoops, particle board. Goodbye. All right, John, you've given us so much great information. How can people find you to learn a little bit more about which industry they should go into? Because I'm going to preface this all with, you said there are 4,000 franchise opportunities out there, but 2,000 are food. So tell us about the greatest 2,000 franchises out there that aren't food, because that's not where you're going, people. Go.
Yeah, we can get you there a lot faster for totally free in a streamlined version. Come out to our website, franbridgeconsulting.com. That's F-R-A-N, franbridgeconsulting.com. Sign up for our monthly newsletter. You know, reach out, connect with me on LinkedIn. Would love to jump on even a 10 or 15 minute call, hear your story, see if it makes sense to take next steps, and happy to help and share resources along the way.
Awesome. Thanks. All right. Small Business Safari. Come on, adventure team. Go make it a great day. And you just dropped some serious gold nuggets for us. Thanks, John. Appreciate you having us on.
Thanks for having us, guys. Enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Small Business Safari. Don't forget to go out and rate, review, and follow me. And if you like this episode, go out and check out my other episodes or check out my Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn for other great content. And remember, your positive attitude will help you achieve your higher altitude in the wild world of small business ownership. Until next time, make it a great day, Adventure Team.